Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, what did Islam ever do for science? Well, apart from algebra, cataract operations, algorithms, hospitals, alkalis, optics and astronomy. Anyway, theoretical physicist Jim Al-Khalili is here to reveal all. Plus, if a prenatal test for autism is developed, could it deprive the world of geniuses? And
I had absolutely no idea that we would get £135,000, and that's just an astonishing and very, very encouraging result.
You wait for an atheist bus, then 800 come along at once. We hop on board with Professor Richard Dawkins. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. So welcome one and all and Happy New Year. This is our first sit-down podcast from the new studios in King's Place. Guardian Science correspondent James Randerson is here in the studio. Hello, James.
Hello.
And the first guest of 2009 is Professor of Theoretical Physics at the University of Surrey, Jim Al-Khalili. Jim, welcome.
Hello.
At the moment, he has a TV series being broadcast on BBC Four called Science and Islam. It's about the achievements in the Islamic world between roughly the 8th and 14th centuries. This week's edition looks at how Egyptian physicist Ibn al-Haytham helped establish the science of optics. Jim, Monty Python asked that classic question, didn't they? What did the Romans ever do for us? Why don't you run us through? What's the Islamic world ever done for science?
Well, I should start by saying that, and this sort of feedback I've been getting in making this program, that people tend to think, if they know anything about it, that the Islamic world didn't do much beyond translate Greek texts into Arabic, keep them warm until the European Renaissance was ready for them to translate them back into Latin. So they didn't actually do anything themselves, and that's very, very far from the truth. So a lot of the words that you hear, like you mentioned algebra, algorithm, alkali, alcohol, are all from the Arabic, and the key here is the al prefix before the word, which is the Arabic definite article, the. It's fascinating digging into this subject just to find out how much they did do that was original. Algebra is the most quoted example.
That's right. Your first episode's already aired last week. Just run us through the basics of that one so that we can move on to discussing the one that's going to be on tonight.
Well, that was basically looking at, you know, why science and Islam? What did the religion of Islam have to do with it? Because we have to make the distinction, this is not Islamic science. I mean, I hate that phrase because there's no such thing as Jewish science or Christian science. It has nothing to do with the religion of those who practice it. But it came about in essentially sort of from the late 8th century, early 9th century AD, when Islam, the Islamic Empire grew and they developed this passion to translate ancient texts from India, Persia and Greece. So the first episode looks at how they then developed things like medicine and built the first hospitals and took Greek mathematics and took it further.
So who are the big characters? Who are the people that we should know about that perhaps we don't?
In my list of greatest scientists in the world, top 10 scientists, usually it's only Europeans we mention, with a smattering of ancient Greeks like Archimedes and Aristotle. I would add to that list Al-Khwarizmi, who is the mathematician who developed algebra, Ibn al-Haytham, essentially the world's first real physicist, Avicenna, Ibn Sina, the great philosopher, physician, and a polymath called Biruni, who was the Islamic Leonardo da Vinci that no one's ever heard of. Fantastic guy.
Did he design a helicopter as well?
He didn't design a helicopter, but what he did do, which is what we cover in the second episode, is he measured the size of the Earth more accurately than anyone else had done before by climbing to the top of a mountain.
James?
There's another al word, alchemy, which comes from the Arabic, and we sort of see alchemy as a kind of slightly hokey idea that you can change base metals into gold and have it distinct from chemistry. But there's a more interesting story there, isn't there?
That's right. It turns out that the distinction between alchemy and chemistry was only made in Europe around about sort of the early 18th century. The al in alchemy is the Arabic, so it came from the Greek chemia, became the Arabic chemia, and then alchemia is the chemistry. So until the 18th century, there was no distinction between chemistry and the chemistry. And then the Europeans decided to redefine one to be a science, to do with experimentation and so on, that was chemistry, and one that was more sort of spiritual, more to do with sort of magic and transmuting base metals into gold. But at the time of the Islamic world, when it was really taken very seriously, there was no distinction. It was just one discipline.
So when Isaac Newton was doing all of his alchemy, he was doing chemistry.
He was doing chemistry.
In his sort of terms.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It was proper science.
And previously you've talked about the Islamic world at the time looking into evolutionary ideas that, you know, way ahead of Darwin. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
There was a 9th century Arab scientist called Al-Jahadh who wrote the Book of Animals, and he had some very rudimentary ideas of how animals would propagate certain characteristics to their offspring. So this wasn't really this was Lamarckism, not Darwinism. But the point is that back then the Muslim scholars were very keen on these, you know, rational picture of the world, very different to what we have in the world today, where there's a lot of anti-Darwinian evolution ideas from all sorts of religious sects around the world.
One of the people in the second program is Ibn al-Haytham. He's a physicist, as you say, someone close to your heart. Tell us a bit more about him.
Yes, you mentioned he was an Egyptian. There's a big debate. I regard him as an Iraqi. Actually, he was born in the Iraqi city of Basra. And I got lots of emails after this first episode from people saying, no, he was Persian, not an Arab, which is a completely different race. So he was born in Iraq. He did a lot of experiments in optics, but essentially he decided to help out the Egyptian caliph regulate the flood of the Nile. So he said, I can build you a dam and canals. He went over to Egypt and realized he'd bitten off more than he can chew and realized he couldn't actually solve that problem. The caliph was mad. He really was a nasty bastard. And so Ibn al-Haytham had to feign madness in order to as a get-out clause. And he was put under house arrest in Egypt. And that's where he wrote his great Book of Optics, where he did a lot of the experiments that we learned at school that Newton devised with prisms and lenses and so on. Ibn al-Haytham got there first with a lot of these things.
So as a physicist yourself, I mean, when you look back at all of this and learnt all of this stuff that you thought Newton had come up with, I mean, how does it impact on your knowledge of your subject? I mean, do you now think to yourself, well, actually, this is something that was thought of well before Newton, and I'm going to credit Ibn al-Haytham with all of this?
Well, listen, Newton was the greatest scientist who ever lived, and that's not I'm not going to challenge that. But science just develops incrementally. No one comes up with scientific ideas and notions out of nothing. You always you stand on the shoulders of giants, as Newton himself said. And so Ibn al-Haytham did develop a lot of science before Newton, and certainly deserves to be known about in the West.
Jim, one of the things that you argue in the second programme is that without Ibn al-Haytham, science itself wouldn't be there. How do you justify that?
Well, okay, I'm to some extent championing his cause, but it's something called the scientific method, the way we do science now. You come up with hypotheses and theories and you do experiments and observation and you see if your theory holds water, and if it doesn't, you throw it away and come up with something else. It's commonly thought that people like Descartes and Francis Bacon were the fathers of the modern scientific method. Well, Ibn al-Haytham was doing that back in the 11th century. He was really doing what we would regard as proper science. Now, you might argue that, well, Aristotle or Archimedes were the first real scientists. And again, it's a gradual thing. But everything that we regard as the way we do science today was in place in Ibn al-Haytham's work.
Even the idea that you can never sort of prove a theory correct, that you can only knock theories down.
Absolutely, yes, because, you know, he would come up, he was very prepared, and it's very clear in his writing, he was very prepared to disband ideas and theories that he'd come up with if his experiments proved them wrong. And that's something that people like Aristotle or even worse, Plato, were very against. You know, don't bother going and doing experiments. It's all to do with pure thought. That, you know, and you have to find something that matches what you think is correct. That's not the way we do science.
Karl Popper will be shocked.
Yes.
For more details on the programme, Science and Islam, go to bbc.co.uk/bbc4. And Jim, staying loosely with religion, we'll be asking for your thoughts later on the Atheist Bus campaign.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Let's have a look at some of the other stories around this week. Here's James and producer Andy with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Humans can survive with much lower blood oxygen levels than previously thought. The findings are based on blood taken at higher altitudes than ever before. During an expedition to the summit of Everest, doctors took measurements from nearly 200 volunteers. They found astonishingly low levels of average blood oxygen, only usually seen in hospital patients who are just about to go into cardiac arrest. The work should help doctors to treat patients in intensive care more effectively.
It's bye-bye burnt fingertips and huge electricity bills as incandescent light bulbs are phased out. Ahead of an EU-wide phase-out in September, shops have voluntarily stopped stocking traditional 100-watt bulbs to make way for greener alternatives. Despite costing a bit more up front, it's estimated that compact fluorescent lamps use about one-fifth of the energy of a standard bulb, as well as lasting much longer.
Could prenatal tests for autism deprive the world of future geniuses? The question was raised by autism specialist Professor Simon Baron Cohen ahead of a new biography of the physicist Paul Dirac. The book claims that the Nobel-winning scientist and a pioneer in quantum mechanics had the condition. A test that diagnoses autism is not yet available, but soon could be.
And finally, the ancient Greeks may have made some cash on the side by turning parts of their homes into bars and brothels. Researchers at excavations across the Greek mainland have uncovered hundreds of drinking cups and erotic objects in homes dating back to the 5th and 4th centuries BC. It suggests rooms and courtyards were used for dubious commercial practices. The discovery may solve the long-standing mystery of why archaeologists have found so little evidence of bawdy Greek tavernas, despite featuring so prominently in classical literature.
James and producer Andy, thank you very much. Let's go straight on to that autism discussion. James, you wrote a blog about this. Why are scientists nowadays looking back and always giving diagnoses to people in the past like this? I mean, did Dirac really have autism? Do we know?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, no, we don't. We can't be sure. But this book from Graham Farmelow called The Strangest Man is about Paul Dirac, of course, this Nobel Prize-winning physicist who is a pioneer in quantum mechanics and quantum electrodynamics. He was a profoundly strange person, and even Einstein remarked on how odd he was. So he was very socially awkward. He would have very, very long silences. He would take what people said to him extremely literally. But of course, at the same time, he was an exceptionally brilliant mind. It's tempting to think, you know, he was a sort of a Rain Man, if you like. He had the kind of the mathematical brilliance, but also the social difficulties that sometimes go with people who are at some point on the kind of autism spectrum. And that's the speculation that Graham Farmelow makes in the book.
Jim, I mean, Paul Dirac was a genius and a very, very important figure in the history of science, quantum mechanics especially. Your subject, tell us what he did, and does it take a slightly strange brain to do it?
I think so. I think some years ago now, there was a survey in Physics World magazine, the top 10 greatest British physicists, I think, of all time. And Dirac came second in that list after Newton. So physicists regard him as hugely influential. He was one of the pioneers of quantum mechanics in the mid-late 1920s. But some of he proposed antimatter for the first time, and people found that a very crazy idea.
He was sort of derided by physicists, wasn't he? When that first came out, and then 2 years later,
it was discovered.
Experimenters discovered it.
Absolutely, and he was one of the forefathers of this theory, quantum electrodynamics, which is wonderful mathematically, but very hard for people to understand. He made lots and lots of discoveries that it's only later people appreciate the significance of. But yeah, he was an extremely...
And he sort of prefigured string theory as well in some ways.
Yes, if you look back in the history of string theory, you can trace it back to him making those similar sorts of ideas.
Simon Baron Cohen's argument is that if we have tests for autism, I mean, autism is a very complex thing to diagnose anyway, then we might deprive the world of these sorts of people.
Yeah, his point is, okay, at the moment we don't have these tests and they're not, you know, on the immediate horizon, but he thinks it may not be that long before, I mean, you know, there are some genes that have been linked with autism, and there may be a point at which you can test for those genes prenatally, and perhaps people might take the decision, I don't want to have a child who's autistic, and therefore I want to abort that child, or perhaps do a IVF testing and, you know, selecting out certain embryos with those genes. And his point is we have to be very careful before we think about going down that route. Apart from the sort of eugenics argument, I suppose there's also this sort of unintended side effect of, you know, some people who perhaps see the world rather differently and may not be at the far end of the autism spectrum and hence have the really, really, you know, crippling social difficulties and, well, general life difficulties that those people have, but are, you know, able to function in real life and are also, because they have this incredible way of seeing the world, are able to make fantastic contributions to life. Simon Baron Cohen's point is that we should have a sort of societal discussion about this before, you know, ahead of the science, so that if a test comes along, we're not suddenly caught on the hop.
All right, well, let's move on to something a bit more parochial, but important, I think. Light bulbs. Again, James seems to be the blog queen right now. But the light bulbs, 100-watt incandescent light bulbs, are going to be phased out in this country by the end of the month. It's a sort of voluntary thing between retailers, which I think is a brilliant thing. They're a complete waste of energy, and mostly, as everyone knows who's been anywhere near them, they just get hot and burn your fingers. Our wonderful Daily Mail got a bit worked up about this, James.
You might say they were incandescent with rage.
You're waiting for that.
Yeah, you know, is it really the most important story in the world to have on your front page on Tuesday?
It is, yeah.
You know, there's a war on. This piece was basically filled with lots of canards about incandescent light bulbs that are now basically out of date. You know, the technology has moved on. There were problems and disadvantages with the early models of some of these, some of the new eco bulbs, which have basically now been fixed, but people still tend to go on about them. I mean, just as a kind of pitch for the new light bulbs, they save you around £7 a year, according to the Energy Saving Trust, in electricity. And that's basically because they don't convert 95% of the electricity into heat rather than into light. And if you fitted all of your light fittings with eco bulbs, over the course of the lifetime of those bulbs, you would save yourself £600. One blogger, Dr. Matt Prescott, who's banned the bulb blog, has looked into this issue in some detail. He reckons that if, based on European Union figures, if all of Europe replaces their light bulbs in domestic homes with the best form of eco bulbs, we'd save between 23 million and 53 million tonnes of carbon dioxide a year. That's about 10 power stations worth.
Just to get a bit boring about this, but to ask you, things like energy efficiency in people's homes is going to be one of the most important things in terms of tackling carbon emissions.
One of the most dull.
And
one,
it is, isn't it? We have to find a way of making this stuff sexy. Jim, do you have energy efficient light bulbs all over your house? I'm assuming you have LED lights and that kind of thing. You're the next generation. Quantum lights, maybe.
wherever possible, yes, we've got the eco light bulbs up, but not everywhere in the house.
Do you get annoyed by people at the Daily Mail sort of selling incandescent light bulbs in the face of climate change, or do you think it's a bit silly that we're getting worried about it?
No, I think it's a valid point. I mean, you're not going to change people's attitudes overnight, and there are so many different things that can be done incrementally, very tiny little changes in our lifestyles. And when people try and sort of put the kibosh on some of these ideas, it is frustrating. You know, energy saving light bulbs aren't going to solve climate change. They and 1,000 other things will help.
But you need to do all 1,000.
We need to do all 1,000. And you've got to get, it's nothing just about light bulbs, it's about people's attitudes to these things. You have to be receptive to all these changes.
I think one point that's worth making is that, I mean, you know, we can rant at the Daily Mail, but basically the people who are at fault here are the government by not preparing public opinion for this change and not kind of communicating the message that, you know, perhaps the eco bulb that you tried 5 years ago that took 2 minutes to warm up to its full light and gave out a slightly strange cold light, those bulbs are not the bulbs that you buy these days. And I think people, you know, perhaps tried them at one point and then have a fixed idea about what's the matter with them. And that's not the case anymore. And
in defence of the Daily Mail, actually, I think that the readers of the Daily Mail, that market is probably the most important in terms of persuading them to do things like change the light bulbs. I mean, when Daily Mail gets behind something, it works very well. When they wanted to ban plastic bags, nearly every retailer in the country stopped stocking them. I think they're a very important organisation. And I think you're right, James, if the public haven't been told about this and clearly the Daily Mail aren't behind this because the public aren't behind it. I mean, they're not stupid. Anyway, for more on all this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science and guardian.co.uk/environment.
Science Weekly.
Our feedback section now, while we look at what you've been saying on the podcast blog and Facebook wall. Just a couple following last week's tour around Guardian's new environmentally friendly headquarters. Imhotepa asks where the Guardian's museum is now, which is a good question, but I don't think we've unpacked it yet, so it might be in the boxes at the back of the second floor. And Matthew Deakin from the University of East Anglia writes, "Yay to the Guardian and your green section. I do love you so. Kiss." I'm not sure if he's being ironic, though. Anyway, that's it for our podcast feedback for the new year. A bit quiet. So we thought it was a good opportunity to have a look at one of the more popular blogs and the science pages. This one's about the potential for a devastating supervolcano exploding in America's Yellowstone National Park. Here are a few of the comments.
Doug Bamford asks, "Is there any way of harnessing this heat for renewable energy? And would utilising the heat or the engineering involved make an eruption more or less likely?"
Here's one from Paul Ratu. "I might be wrong, but knowing there's going to be a massive eruption, unless we know accurately a number of years in advance, seems to be of no real use. The only way knowing would be useful is if we had enough time to make preparations to protect the population."
Zuprunara points out, "So we now have to stop worrying about global warming and prepare ourselves for global cooling instead. A case of from the frying pan into the freezer?"
Well, that blog was actually written by Bill Maguire, who is a professor of natural hazards and disasters. So, you know, it's not going to be good news, is it? So you can join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall or leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. At the time of recording, we're on the cusp of 1,000 members in our Facebook group, so that's very exciting. An advertising campaign aimed at persuading more people to come out as atheists has been launched. The slogan, "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life," is already on buses in London. It follows an internet campaign that raised more than £140,000. The success of the British campaign has inspired atheists in the US to run their own advertising slogans in Washington, D.C., which read, "Why believe in God? Just be good for goodness sake." James, you went to the launch of this campaign. How was it?
It was a bit of a kind of atheist loving, although at times it was it felt a bit like a C of E coffee morning, I must say. There was a certain fluffiness to the whole thing. I actually really liked the Australian slogan, which didn't apparently they tried to get on some buses in Australia, but someone said they couldn't, and that was atheism, stay in bed on a Sunday morning. I spoke to several people at the launch, including Ariane Sherin, who, of course, came up with the campaign following a blog on Comet is Free. And also, of course, Professor Richard Dawkins was there.
I was delighted by the response to the campaign in the sense of financial contributions. £135,000, all raised in, not all, but most of it raised in small contributions, £5 here, £10 there, £20 there. I think that's an amazing statement that's being made about a mood in this country.
And what do you say to those people who say, you know, the quotes new atheists are sort of strident and offensive?
It is the most astonishing thing that if you say something religious, that's fine. But if you say something much milder that's non-religious, you're strident and shrill. We are not strident and shrill. We are just saying perfectly reasonable things. In this particular case, we're saying, think for yourself. That's all we're saying. It's not strident and shrill.
And would you have wanted the slogan to be stronger than it is?
I would have chosen a slightly stronger slogan, but I wouldn't have wanted to say there's definitely no God, just the same way as I wouldn't want to say there's definitely no Father Christmas.
We've got 800 buses with the atheist advert running across the UK. It all started last June when I was walking into work and I saw two buses with Bible quotes on the side. And I thought, that's quite unusual. You don't often see that. And the ads had a prominent URL on them. So when I got to work, I was a bit bored and I thought I'd look up the site out of curiosity. And it told me, among all other things, that all non-Christians were going to burn in hell for all eternity. And I thought, hang on a sec, this is 2008. And I couldn't quite believe that these kinds of ideas were being spread from the side of a bus to scare people.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince, and I suppose I'm one of those traditional ranting atheist comedians that have sprung up around the country. I suppose we're at a very early stage before we know if it has achieved anything. But I think what it will do is it is going to achieve discussion. There will be people who immediately are affronted by this, it will be ridiculous. I have looked on the internet and there are people going, oh, terrible that these things should happen. You think, well, not really, because as an atheist, I don't feel that I have to go and stand with a placard outside a church service on a Sunday. I don't feel affronted by people going every Sunday to do that. I don't feel affronted by going past Baptist churches or Anglican churches or Unitarian churches with their big signs about Jesus out the front. So this is merely the alternative opinion. And of course, it's not actually an atheist bus. I suppose technically it's an agnostic bus, because it's only there's probably no God. Which is the scientific, as you know, the scientific viewpoint, because we can't ultimately prove that there is no God. But I'm taking the risk.
Comedian Robin Ince there. Jim, have you been waiting for an atheist bus to come along?
I find it actually very amusing. I like the story that, is it Christian Watch who are taking them to court?
It's Christian Voice.
Christian Voice. It sort of just reminded me of the film Miracle on 34th Street, where they're trying to prove the existence or non-existence of Father Christmas. Chris Kringle, David Attenborough's character. I mean, I think it's good. I mean, in the same way that, many atheists, we sort of cringe a bit when Richard Dawkins is so outspoken, what it's doing is making this a respectable thing to discuss with people of faith. Atheism was seen as an extreme viewpoint, and anyone sensible had to be middle of the road agnostic. Richard Dawkins has made sort of more sort of cuddlier atheists a bit more respectable and middle of the road, and so you feel you can stand up and say, yes, I'm an atheist, even though I'm not probably quite prepared to go around insulting people with faith.
There is a thing there that atheism is very tied in with science, isn't it? Why do you think that's happened?
I'm not sure why. I think it's an interesting point. Actually, it links in with our early discussion about some science and Islam. That here we are, 2009, Darwin year. A discussion, debate about evolution versus creationism hasn't happened in the Islamic world, and I think that's partly because a lot of Muslims associate evolution theory and Darwinism with atheism. And that's very wrong. And that's something that, to get that debate about evolution going in the Islamic world, which I think is vitally important, we have to separate it from atheism. There are many Christians in the West who are perfectly happy to believe that Darwinian evolution is correct, but still have a religious faith. I think that has to change. So I think atheism and science, in some sense, need to be separated.
Do you think there's a danger then that if people in the Islamic world don't look at Darwinian evolution as a sort of way of explaining how species change and develop, that they're going to perhaps take people like Harun Yahya more seriously with his kind of crazy, what he calls Islamic evolution, or whatever he calls it now? I mean, is there a danger?
I think there is a danger. I think the debate hasn't happened. A lot of people in the Muslim world simply haven't thought about it. But if pushed, the majority, in fact, will deny evolution theory, or they will accept evolution theory up to humans and say, but humans didn't evolve from apes, but they're happy to talk about other lower life forms and plants and animals evolving. So yes, there is a danger, and the debate has to happen somehow, but you have to tread carefully.
If you look at where the sort of significant scientific papers in the world come from, a very small proportion of them come from the Islamic world, and if you like, the Arabic world. Is that starting to change? With all this, huge amounts of money that some of those countries have because of the oil wealth, are they sort of realizing and trying to reverse that and put money into science, or are things still pretty bad?
It is starting to change. In a lot of countries like, Malaysia, Pakistan, Iran, the Gulf states, they're pouring money into science, but it's still technology driven, economically driven. It's science to help build up those countries' economies. It's still not quite science for the sake of inquiry, and that hasn't happened. I mean, I sometimes get papers to referee in physics journals from physicists in Pakistan, India, Saudi Arabia. And you can see that what they're doing, they're trying really hard. They don't have the big sort of computers or the laboratories that we have in the West. And on the one hand, you want to compare them, if you want to accept a paper for publication, it has to be of the right standards for a journal. But on the other hand, you sort of feel that you want to encourage them to be doing this sort of research. And it is starting, but it has a long way to go.
The last programme in your series is about astronomy. Tell us a bit about what you're going to be covering in that.
I discover a sundial in Damascus, which was built by a Syrian astronomer 14th century, Ibn Shatr, which was sort of lost. And so there's this great discovery. They find the sundial up in one of the minarets of the Umayyad Mosque in the center of Damascus. And that's all very exciting because he was one of the astronomers that helped develop the maths that Copernicus then used hundreds of years later. We also travel up into the mountains of northern Syria to discover a mountain fort that used to be one of the assassins' hideaways. The assassins comes from the Persian Hashashin, which was an Ismaili Muslim sect. And when the Mongols invaded through Persia, this was the one fort that they couldn't quite capture. And this is where an astronomer spent 20 or so years of his life, Al-Tusi, developing astronomy. And then when the Mongols invaded, depending on which side of the story you believe, they either rescued him from the assassins or they kidnapped him from the assassins. But in any case, he convinced the Mongols to build him a new observatory where a lot of great discoveries were made in astronomy, long before, by the way, the discovery of the invention of the telescope.
Oh, we're looking forward to that. Sounds like you had a good time traveling around anyway.
it was okay, apart from getting salmonella poisoning.
Oh, goodness.
That wasn't very pleasant.
I hope that's not on screen.
That was going to be part of the story, me looking very, very ill, but I think that's been edited out.
Well, you look very well now. Well, thank you so much, Jim, for all of that. Jim Al-Khalili's series, Science and Islam, is on the BBC at the moment, as well as on iPlayer, of course. My thanks also to James Randerson, Guardian Science correspondent. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.